This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn. I'm Chua Ntsik. Preacher and comedian might sound like an odd pairing, but Preacher Moss, an African-American Muslim comedian, has years under his belt when it comes to comedy. Best known as one third of comedy trio All Make Me Funny, he joins me today to discuss how he uses humor to dispel religious and cultural myth across the world. Preacher Moss, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, sir.
So I read that you grew up in Maryland. Maybe we can start there. Could you tell me a bit about your childhood and early
actually
years?
Washington, D.C. area, Maryland, Virginia, D.C. It's pretty much blurred lines, if you will. I don't want to say blurred lines. I might have to. There's a copyright on that. I don't want to get sued. I like Marvin Gaye. Right. No, but D.C., Washington, D.C. is a melting pot in terms of politics and culture. A lot of people don't realize that a lot of the laws that are made that affect the United States and summarily the world come out of this really, really small town. It's not even a state. It's a city. But that's where I grew up. That's where I was born. And a lot of the philosophies that I take away as, of course, as a black man, but as an artist, as an activist, as an educator, come from that orientation.
Could you tell me more about the laws that you were talking about?
Well, you know, you have crime and drugs, but there's a mindset that went along with that, which was, you know, the idea of policing, you know, because you have to look beyond. When I was born in 66, but you had the Nixon years, you had the Reagan years, and those things affected the world. Mm. You know, and now we have the Trump years. It might be the Trump months. We don't know.
Trump.
We don't know how long it's going to last.
We'll get into that.
Yes, but, sir.
Before,
yes, sir.
How did you get your nickname, Preacher?
Be careful what you ask for is how I would preface that. But I used to do imitations of the minister at my mom's church giving really bad sermons. And, you know, you're 6 and 7 and you're bored. And the guy, he was a nice man, but he was just a horrible public speaker. So I think preacher and bad public speaking shouldn't go together. But in this case, they did. And it was horrific watching this man give him a sermon. It was painful. And I used to elicit laughs doing my own rendition of Reverend Johnson called Reverend Spitty Mouth, which was hilarious for 7, 8-year-old kids. And once the adults caught me, I thought I was getting in trouble, but, you know, they paid me more than the kids were paying me in summer school. I mean, Sunday school. So it went from, you know, Reverend Spitty Mouth to that kid, Preacher Moss. And it stuck with me. So it's a nickname. It's not a stage name or anything like that.
And did your mom take this very well?
Absolutely not, brother. Mom hated it. Grandma hated it. My dad loved it because it was a pretty dead-on accurate impression of the man, but they're religious folks, and they spent lots of time and energy in that church. And you know, for me to be doing what I was doing, you know, I wasn't a preacher's kid, but I was an usher's kid, which is ranks right up there. And you know, I just found that, you know, some of the idiosyncrasies of trying to be a public speaker and religion, I thought it was funny. You know, no disrespect to Jesus or the Holy Ghost or a God, you know. They're cool, but this guy talking about it to me was funny, and that was the beginning of my comedy, just being able to look at people and pick out certain nuances and kind of explore them and exploit them for cheap laughs and money. So
so that's where it started. That's where it started, man.
But it starts out, you know, you're just expressing yourself, and it just so happens the kids thought – my kids my age thought it was funny, and adults my age – who weren't my age actually thought it was funny, and that was the fire, you know. So I guess I was a paid professional when I was about 7 or 8 years old.
Yeah, I asked about your mom because I read that she didn't take too well when she learned of your conversion. But maybe before we get to that, you converted to Islam at the age of 20. Can you tell us why?
I grew up Christian, but I didn't grow up confidently Christian, which meant that I had a lot of issues in the context of how it was practiced as a religion and I was a child of the 60s. So coming through the power movements, you saw where you had a term called white Christians. And they weren't Christian at all. they were disrespectful, dangerous to blacks, Latinos, to Asians. And they would still call themselves Christian. I just couldn't identify with them. I'm like, well, Jesus is this way. How can you be that way? Segregated churches. These are things that you're seeing as a young man. I'm like, and as a young black man, you're growing. And I had the opportunity to learn and explore the experience in the lives of Martin Luther King, but also Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad. Though I didn't join the Nation of Islam, it gave me a much different perspective.
How old were you when those people were writing and speaking?
Man, I think I ran across Malcolm X when I was maybe like 8. You know, because my father always had a copy of Autobiography of Malcolm X. And so I grew up in that power, the black power struggle, but also the black power vacuum, which was the vacuum is where does black intellectual thought go? And where I found comfort in it was looking at some of the comedians of that time, which were Dick Gregory, Godfrey Cambridge, who were really activists and comedians. And then comes along, of course, Richard Pryor, Bill Cosby, not so much, but Richard Pryor and Carlin. And then you know, that becomes that vacuum all of a sudden is now it's not a vacuum, it's a well. And it's feeding, at the time, a really, really young mind. And for years, I really didn't identify or even acknowledge Muslims other than Nation of Islam because that's what made me comfortable. That gave me a particular type of logic. Then you go to college, and then you meet Muslims who are not in the Nation of Islam, Muslims who come on an exchange, almost like Malcolm talked about. You meet Muslims that are Asian, Chinese, we Chinese, Indian, Pakistani, and it's like, oh, okay. But then you see the other side of Malcolm's enlightenment about going to Mecca, and I'm like, it's this whole big world out there. And that whole big world was very comfortable because it just weren't, you can ask questions and you can have them answered. You can answer those questions. And it wasn't in this cloud of mystery. And, you know, Christianity, the way it was practiced, particularly how my grandmother viewed it, my grandfather viewed it, I didn't trust it because I looked at how it affected them socially. And so you have to calibrate those feelings. Now, all of this to say is that I'm not anti-Christian. That's not what it is. I still support most of my family is still Christian. So, you know, I love them and the good things about what they practice, and they love me, and the good things about what I practice. But you ask a very good question because there's a lot of confusion, and a lot of times people exploit that confusion, and they turn it into fear, you know. Because they say, you know, ignorance is a really short leap from fear, mm-hmm. and vice versa. So
How was that conversation with your mom, though?
You know, I joke, but it's true. I was afraid to tell her. So I left clues. The problem is I left really bad clues, you know. But the larger picture is it's a really beautiful story. It's a long story. But it's of a mother who's going, well, if this is what you think you need to do to be a productive human being or be a better human being, then you need to do that. And a lot of times we don't have that conversation. And it's very black and white. Mom's like, you need to do that. What I have over here, I've been doing for years, and it works for me. She goes, but I don't run your life. You need to go out there, and I say this a lot to guys I grew up with, guys that are still on the block, they're in the inner city or whatever, guys coming out of prison. I'm like, look, man, there's a really, really big world out here outside of what's been introduced to you in terms of the world, in terms of options, in terms of alternative skills you can acquire, you know, but we have to get out of this mentality that this is all there is. I'm in Malaysia on that same spirit, man. You know, I could have just sat around and go, well, I hope somebody books me to come to Malaysia. I'm like, wait, I'm making money. I got cash. I'm going to Malaysia. chalk it up to Malcolm X, chalk it up to Elijah Muhammad, chalk it up to Warfdeen Muhammad, that the world is wide and expanse, and if you don't get out there and explore it, you know, then, you know, whose fault is it? It's yours. So I think because of that, that's really inspired myself as a comedian and an educator, which led to things like Allah Made Me Funny, which was started in the African-American Muslim community, designed, but we started it in the larger immigrant Muslim community because we were cool. We knew all, we always say, we always knew the tricknology of the U.S. government, but a lot of Muslims did not, and they were scared, and they were confused. Why do they not like us anymore? I'm like, hey, brother, this is America. It can switch on a dime. And we put together a tour that combined basically the face of Islam in the United States. We had an immigrant Muslim. We had a Nation of Islam Muslim. We had a Sunni Muslim, myself. And we went throughout the country and then eventually out throughout the world with this message that resonated with a lot of people.
I'm speaking today to Preacher Moss, a stand-up comedian and writer. I'll ask him more about his work with Allah Make Me Funny after this short break, BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. My guest today is Preacher Moss, a writer, stand-up comedian, and one-third of the comedy troupe Allah Make Me Funny. You know, in the introduction I did earlier in the program, I introduced you as an African-American Muslim comedian. It's a very multi-hyphenated identity. Are you conscious about that, you know, every day as you go about?
You could have just said, very good-looking black man. I think that got lost in the break. We're going to edit that in and not concede it. No, there's a lot of history to unpack there. We talk about Allah Made Me Funny. A lot of people just don't realize how much history there was to unpack just with that tour. And it started in 2004, you know, where we started, where we began, and where we ended up. A lot of highs and lows. We started out with, we had Azhar Usman, we had Azim Muhammad as the first group, and then Azim left the group, and then we had Muhammad Amr. So it changed the dynamic of the group greatly. But I think, you know, that term, unfortunately, you're correct. There's a lot of hyphenation in that, and none of it fully explains who you are. It really just highlights the condition in which we live. You know, I'm very clear now. When I see somebody, I don't go, hey, you're, I don't know. I clearly don't know. And I play the safe role of just being, you know, I'm going to be blissfully ignorant until you tell me what it is you're about, what you believe, where you're from, who your parents, what's your bloodline, what's your not your bloodline, what's your language, you know, because I'm like, people need that space. I like to say people need that safe space to introduce themselves and introduce their ideas. And all that made me funny was that in 2004, because it had never been done before.
Do you think it's more difficult to have that attitude now in light of the last election cycle because identity politics is so much at the forefront?
Well, yeah, identity politics. But before that, you had race identity politics. And the breakdown of race identity politics was very incomplete because what it did, it pulled back the sheets on some things, which you have to do. But there was no verifiable explanation of what you're seeing. And so in America, you have people who are angry because they feel like I'm in the same boat as the person I've been putting down for the last 20, 30, 40 years. So you have a backlash. So the Asian businessman who's been on the corner for years doing business, you know, doing business in a black neighborhood, doing business, all of a sudden somebody goes, well, he's taking advantage of our people. No, that store was there for 30, 40 years. You could have gotten that store, or you could have gone to that person and say, listen, I'm thinking of opening a store down the street, you know, and we gets beyond the fact that it's business and we start making excuses for why I'm not ahead. So what you have in America now is a very weird conundrum where white America has a problem with white America. And they realize they can't speak to the powerful part of white America, which is this House, the Senate. See, they're passing bills nobody wants. Donald Trump is signing executive orders. And people are going, wait a minute, that's not what we thought it was going to be. No, that's exactly what it's going to be. People were telling you, but you know, you live in this weird utopia. I'm like, politicians, we loved Obama. But in the end, I'm like, look, Obama's a politician. He has to do politician things. So, you know, the kumbaya moment, you know, the change you can believe in. I'm like, yeah, change you can believe in until you got to change. And I think that's the thing now. So the backlash is people are really in the state of denial. And they've been in a state of denial since Obama's reelection, really in 2012. That was a mandate. I always say that was like a mandate on whiteness or white supremacy. Like, all things considered, whiteness will win in America, and it didn't win. And people lost their minds, and they stewed and they brewed to the last election. And forget, we could have had the first female president. It's like, we don't like this chick either. There's two white people, and they're going, which white person do I like less? We just can't give it to her. We're going to give it to him. And now you see all of this weirdness. So, I mean, I live in America, but it's news to me is like reality TV now. You know, every day is something. Like, it's like a bad relative that stays at your house. Every day, something's broken. Who broke the lamp? I did. Who ate the last sandwich? I did. Who drank the juice? I did. And it's like, it becomes this weird normalcy. So that's where we are right now. And unfortunately, it's beginning to permeate around the world. Where there's this foolishness, this idea that it's okay for me to not be equitable towards you. It's okay for me to not practice proper etiquette towards you. The ignorant person could go, you know what? I could stay ignorant. Yeah. So dumbness and foolishness is at a premium. I mean, we got a president that tweets. Come on, dude. I mean, he tweets and he misspells stuff. I don't know if, you know, Twitter has spell check, but evidently not, looking at some of his tweets. But I'm like, come on, man, you're carrying on, bro. This is not real life. It's not even politics. Even the politicians are going, what's happening to the idea of politics? So, I mean, when you look at that, yeah, it's interesting. And I'm only saying this because I'm giving you a context of where we started as a Muslim comedy tour as a response to 9/11 going back to 2003, 2004. And we could have never foreseen this. Like, Muslim comedians are like stuck because half the time the things you were talking about, it almost feels like a lie.
Do you think in the last 20, 30 years, there is this three broad categories in a pre-9/11, post-9/11, and now in the Trump era where the Muslim experience in America is radically, vastly different?
Well, I'll break it down. African Muslim experience, African American Muslim experience is the same. It's the same. The reason I say it's the same is because we are insulated by our communities, meaning that maybe not in America, but in the inner cities, Islam is mainstream. It's reflected in hip hop, it's reflected in jazz, it's, you know, the joke is every black person has a Muslim cousin or uncle or auntie or brother goes in, get locked up for 3 years, he comes out Muslim. We laugh at those jokes, but those are reality. That's a true. There's something to that. But in the end...
But it's not as prominent as the black churches in pop culture, right?
Muslims, African-American Muslims are almost avant-garde because there's a... Now, there's a trajectory. So you have the Ahmadiyya Muslims who are about race equality, but that was like with Indian Pakistani people. And then you had the Lost Found Nation. Then you had the Moorish Science Temple. Then you had the Nation of Islam, which begins to speak to the people at that time about racial inequity. And it's a religion that gives, it's a protest religion. The Christian religion back in the day becomes a protest religion with Martin Luther King. Doesn't sustain it as a protest religion going into the power movements, the Black Panther movement, SNCC, all that type of stuff. So the Black church has in some regard been relegated to the back seat. Though I think they're still effective in their spaces. They haven't been able to put out major things. They haven't been able to produce a Million Man March like Minister Louis Farrakhan. You can't call a million Black men to the Capitol to talk about issues of redemption. They can't do that. But I think in a larger scope, you know, and I don't want to get too far along, but in a larger scope, man, you know, the Black church has not been able to evolve institutions of Black scholarship as it pertains to Black theology. So I think that's an issue. So a lot of times the youth are able to come up to a point in terms of religious training, but that point is not like 2017. That point is more like maybe 1995 in terms of effectiveness, in terms of initiatives. So, I mean, that's something that's a great topic, man. That's probably another topic for another show.
You said earlier that you were a teacher for a time. What did you do after college? Did you pursue writing and comedy after that, or were you a teacher for?
I started stand-up when I was 17. The problem was, at 17, I was too young to work in regular comedy clubs, which takes me on a trajectory where I'm working with jazz bands on pickup gigs, where they pay me a little, and I'd open the show, and then I'd drive or whatever. And then it would take me on longer gigs. So my development, my first 4 years of development as a comedian is basically as a musician. Watching, even my style now, how I write is reflective of watching jazz musicians write, their philosophy on how you put a song together, tone, pitch, you know, tonality of the voice, what key is that in, you know, is it pleasant to the listener's ear? Outside of, you know, those are things you think, because most comedians, like, I'm going to tell this joke and I hope they like it. For me, it was like, I'm going to tell this joke, but I'm gonna take them on a little journey to get them there. And then they'll appreciate it a lot more than I just, you know, two nuns walking to a bar. Nah, I'm going to take you way further. We're going to get there. They're going to be at the bar, but it's going to be so fun, the trip to get there. So, I mean, that... you know, that was it. Plus, I also had the foundation of teaching youth, working as an outreach worker, working as a group home counselor with adjudicated kids, kids who are in and out of the court system, kids that are in juvenile detention. I had an opportunity to work with them. So that grounded me. I think so I'm never really, I never feel like I'm going to be a comedian. It's going to get a big head because you know what life is. You know what life is before you got to that microphone. So you know what life is when your buddy has to go do 20 years or your buddy is dead or teaching children. And, you know, this is something that comes out of my comedy. You're teaching children knowing that you don't know if they're going to make it. You know, but you got to show up every day and give it your best shot. So those are things that go into my philosophy of stand-up. And by the time I became old enough to go into the regular comedy clubs, I was a very different look, man. I was a totally weird drink of water for them. Like, they freaked out that I actually talked to the audience.
Like, why, because of the subject of your jokes or because of your delivery?
Yeah, it was a lot of things. I wasn't loud. I wasn't a physical comic jumping up and down. When I really got to it, honestly, I was Muslim, so I was clean.
But how would they know that? How would they know that you're a Muslim if you don't tell them?
You know, brother, I'm going to say something. I've run across so many brothers, I didn't know they didn't say they were Muslim, but you hung out with them, you're like, dude, you're Muslim, aren't you? Like, yeah, I am. It's just a different flow. And it's funny because Azeem was on All Made Me Funny. He and I meet in Madison, Wisconsin, of all places. He's the opener. I'm the headliner. And, of course, he has Muslim name Azeem. But I'm just preaching Moss. And I think the second night, I was drinking cider. And he was like, "You drinking cider?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "I like cider, too." And I'm like, we realized both of us are Muslim. And, of course, the management was freaking out because we weren't really promoting alcohol. That's how club owners know. You don't go out, "Hey, did your drinks?" Nah, I'm not doing that, man. I mean, you know, you bring up a really, really great question, which is, I think, touch on a great topic, which is, what's the fine line between social activism and social responsibility as entertainers, particularly comedians? It's so blurred now. Just things that are being said. And it's reflective in society now. You know, some of the crudeness, I remember Barack Obama giving a speech, somebody yells like, "You're lying." I'm like, who does that? You know, who does that? When and where does that become okay? You know, and, you know, my deeper material really goes into, you know, race equality, race inequity. And what I've learned over the years is like, okay, cool. You started out with African Americans, but it expanded to, you know, the Asian, you know, the Asian diaspora to the United States, and how women evolve in the suffrage movement. And, you know, they always say, you know, but those narratives never go away. They never go away. And even the unfairness of whites, that they visit upon other whites, which isn't highlighted. But being a comedian going around the country, you go to spots where, man, white people are just barely holding on. You know, here's the last rung. They're about right here underneath. And I'm like, wow. You know, but as a Muslim, I'm saying, you know, that's still my brother. That's still my sister. You still gotta help them out.
How do they receive your material? Because you tour college campuses and high schools as well.
For the most part, I would just right in front and say, man, it's been a blessing to be able to do it, and then do it for as long as I've done it. I'm 50 now, but I remember hitting these college campuses when I was 31, 30. And the college campuses, they've changed in the dynamics in terms of technology. So everybody has a smartphone, everybody has a computer, you have social media. I think you had a greater chance to inform the public or tell that person beside you, "Hey, this is me," before social media. Because social media is basically, I can blast out my opinion, I can blog, and I can say whatever I want to. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. If I have an audience, that's even better. But you know, man, they received it well. And I think the last couple years, particularly with Obama in office, I had a tour called End of Racism Comedy Lecture Tour. Which, you know, got awards. Alhamdulillah, you know, best diversity artist, you know, as a speaker and combination lecture and comedy. But it was built on aspects of critical race theory, which examined the laws that affect us racially, the laws that are on the books that create unfairness. And the question is, why, if these laws are disadvantageous to you or to my brother over here, if it's disadvantageous to you brothers, then why does it still get to stay on the books? You know, if it's advantageous to me, no, you have to systematically take that apart. That's what was happening in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and now in the 80s and the 90s and 2000s. People don't invest that kind of time and understanding legal implications of how you practice faith, how you practice your culture, how you practice your vote. You know, so now we have a generation who are basically angry. Angry or lost or upset because that investment isn't made. And so that leaves as your last stand, your last line of defense, comedians.
You said in previous interviews that in performances, you invite the audience to revisit the art of reason. What do you mean by that?
I like to strip things down. Like when I talk about racism, I learned several years ago, you know, if you speak to the emotional side of it, people will never get it. You invite people not to look at, like your show, the bigger picture. However, if you are very systemic and taking it apart, like if I talk about racism, I read something, a book called Purification of the Heart. It was narrated by Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. It's a classic text, but Purification of the Heart, which is, you know, clearing up the things that disease your heart, if you will. They talked about race, but they put in language of oppression. Your race is a hotbed topic in the United States. Oppression is all over the world. And they said, you know, the three things that comprise oppression are arrogance, envy, and iniquity. You know, arrogance, envy, and iniquity. You can apply arrogance. I'm just looking at you going, hey, man, I don't really know you, but I know I'm better than you. And envy is like, oh, man, you got on a nice shirt. I want that shirt. I should have that shirt because I'm better than you. And iniquity is the last part where, in my mind, I think I could take your shirt. And people are like, wait, I never thought of it like that. I'm like, yeah. Which means you don't even have to be around a person or a particular situation. It's just being your spirit. And it can happen anytime. It's just that quick. That person who was your friend, it was just that quick. That person you thought you were cool with, it was just that quick. You know, to me, racists are not the most creative people in the world because they do the same three things. I don't know if any Trump supporters are listening. I know you're going to hate this, but here we go. Racists do the same three things. Whatever it is that's good about you, they discredit. Whatever it is that's bad about you, they highlight. And whatever it is they don't know about you, they make up. Because you have to be able to talk to and connect with the lowest common denominator in a room, in a conversation, in a classroom. And that is the idea of inviting people back to reason. And I think what was particularly effective back then was I wasn't I understood racism. I experienced racism. I didn't like racism. Racism got me upset, sure. But overall, I wasn't angry. Because once you become angry, you lose relevance. And I used to make it a point, I'm not angry. You know, I'm like, I don't know if you're racist or you're not. I'm looking at a conditioning scenario, but I'm not angry. In fact, I'm enlightened. That's why I'm here. I'm able to sit here in front of this college audience and say these things, or this church and say these things, or this mosque and say these things, or this, you know, this Jewish temple and say these things. You know, because the clarity is the thing that you want to make sure that you're focused on. And you want to make sure that people feel that because you want to inspire clarity and sober thinking, as we like to say, back in the day.
Preacher, this is not your first time in Malaysia, isn't it?
Absolutely, man. I am having a blast. Big shout out to my main man, Nizal Muhammad, my sidekick over in the corner. Big brother for Deuce, for Reed, my main man Justin, and hopefully when we come through, man, when we have a show, I'd love for you to come out and enjoy it and kick back. But hey, man, thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it, and we hope to see you again.
Preacher Moss, stand-up comedian, writer, one third of All That Make Me Funny. You have been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.